drawers, which lay upturned on the floor. An old steamer chest lay on its side, its lid torn off, its contents scattered onto the carpet. An open door showed me that the bedroom hadn't been spared the rough stuff either. Clothes and broken bits of finery lay strewn around everywhere. The man inside Rule's apartment looked like a catalog model for Thugs R Us. He stood a hand taller than me, and I couldn't tell where his shoulders left off and his neck began. He wore old frayed breeches and a sweater with worn elbows and a hat that looked like an import from the Depression-era Bowery, a round bowler decorated with a gray band. He carried a worn leather satchel in one meat slab hand, and with the other he scooped up pieces of paper, maybe index cards, from a shoebox on an old writing desk, depositing them in the bag. The satchel bulged, but he kept adding more to it with rapid, sharp motions. He muttered something else, emitted a low rumble, and snatched up a Rolodex from the desk, cramming it into the satchel. I drew back from the door and put my back against the wall. There wasn't any time to waste, but I had to figure out what to do. If someone had shown up at Rule's place to start swinging papers, it meant that Rule had been hiding evidence of one kind or another. Therefore, I needed to see whatever it was Kong had in that satchel. Somehow I doubted he would show me if I asked him pretty please, but I didn't like my other option either. In such tight quarters and with other residents nearby, I didn't dare resort to any kind of my kaboom magic. Kaboom magic, or evocation, is difficult to master, and I'm not very good at it. Even with my blasting rod as a focus, I had accidentally dealt out structural damage to a number of buildings. So far, I'd been lucky enough not to kill myself. I didn't want to push it if I didn't have to. Of course, I could always just jump the thug and try to take his bag away. I had a feeling I'd be introduced to a whole new realm of physical discomfort, but I could try. I took another peek at the thug. With one hand, he casually lifted the sofa that had the weight of a couple hundred pounds and peered under it. I drew back from the door again. Fisticuffs. Bad idea. Definitely a bad idea. I chewed on my lip a moment more. Then I slipped the blasting rod back into the flower box, squared up my FTD hat, stepped around the corner, and knocked on the half-open door. The thug's head snapped around toward me along with most of his shoulders. He bared his teeth, anger in his eyes. FTD, I said, trying to keep my voice bland. I've got a delivery here for Mr. Rule. You want to sign for it? The thug glowered at me from beneath the shelter of his overhanging brow.
Rule ain't here.
Like I care. I pushed the pen at him with the other hand. Just sign it and I'll get going. This time he glared at the pen, then at me, then he set the satchel on the coffee table.
Whatever.
Great. I stepped past him and put the flower box down on the table. He clutched the pen in his fist and scrawled on the bottom of the paper. I reached down with one hand as he did, plucked a piece of paper a little bigger than a playing card from the satchel, and palmed it. I got my hand back to my side just before he finished, growled, and shoved the clipboard at me.
Now, he said, leave.
You bet, I told him. Thanks. I turned to go, but his hand shot out and his fingers clamped on my arm like a steel band. I looked back. He narrowed his eyes, nostrils flared, and then growled,
I don't smell flowers.
The bottom fell out of my stomach, but I tried to keep the bluff going.
What are you talking about, Mr.
I glanced down at the clipboard. Grum. Mr. Grum? He leaned down closer to me, and his nostrils flared again, this time with a low snuffling sound.
I smell magic. Smell wizard.
My smile must have turned green to go with my face. Grum took my throat in one hand and lifted me straight up off the ground with a strength no human could duplicate. My vision reduced itself to a hazy tunnel, and the clipboard fell from my fingers. I struggled against him uselessly. His eyes narrowed, and he bared more teeth in a slow smile.
Should have minded your own business, whoever you are.
His fingers started tightening, and I thought I heard something crackle and pop. I had to hope it was his knuckles instead of my trachea.
Whoever you were.
It was too late by far to use my shield bracelet, and my blasting rod lay out of reach on the coffee table. I fumbled in my pocket as my vision started to go black, for the only weapon I had left. I had to pray that I was right in my guess. I found the old iron nail, gripped it as best I could, and shoved it hard at Grum's beefy forearm. The nail bit into his flesh. He screamed, a throaty basso bellow that shook the walls. He flinched and spun, hurling me away from him. I hit the door to Rule's bedroom, slamming it all the way open, and got lucky. I landed on the bed rather than one of the wooden pillars at its corners. If I'd hit one of those, I'd have broken my back. Instead, I hit the bed, bounced, fetched up hard against the wall, then tumbled back to the bed again. I glanced up to see that Grum looked very different than he had a moment before. Rather than the film noir tough guy get-up, he wore a loincloth of some kind of pale leather, and nothing more. His skin was a dark russet, layered with muscle and curling dark hair. His ears stood up from the sides of his head like satellite dishes, and his features had flattened, becoming more bestial, nearly like those of a gorilla. He was also better than 12 feet tall. He had to hunch over to stand, and even so, his shoulders pressed against the 10-foot ceiling. With another roar, Grum tore the nail from his arm and flung it to one side. It went completely through the wall, leaving a hole the size of my thumb. Then he spun back to me, baring teeth, now huge and jagged, and took a stalking step toward me, the floor creaking beneath his feet. "Ogre!" I wheezed. "Crap!" I extended my hand toward the blasting rod and focused my will. "Ventus servitas!" A sharp and sudden torrent of air caught up the flower box and hurled it straight toward me. It hit me in the chest, hard enough to hurt, but I snatched it, brought out my blasting rod, and trained it on Grum as he closed on me. I slammed more will through the rod, its tip bursting into scarlet incandescence. "Fuego!" I barked as I released the energy. Fire, in a column the size of my clenched fist, flashed out at Grum and splashed against his chest. It didn't slow him down. Not by a second. His skin didn't burn, his hair didn't even singe. The fire of my magic spilled over him and did absolutely nothing. Grum shouldered his way through the bedroom door, cracking the frame as he did, and raised his fist. He slammed it down at the bed, but I didn't wait around to meet it. I flopped over to the far side of the bed and tumbled down to the space between the bed and the wall. He reached for me, but I rolled underneath the bed, bumping against his feet, and scrambled toward the door. I almost made it, but something heavy and hard slammed against my legs, taking them out from under me and knocking me down. I only had time to realize, dimly, that Grum had picked up an antique Victorian chair that resembled, more than anything else, a throne, and hurled it at me. The pain kicked in a second later, and I crawled toward the door. The ogre's feet pounded in rapid succession, and the floor shook as he grew closer and closer to me. From the hall, a querulous female voice demanded,
"What's all that racket? I've already called the police, I have! You fruits, get out of our hall, or we'll lock you away!"
Crumb stopped. I saw frustration and rage flicker over his ape-like features. Then he snarled, stepped over me, and picked up the satchel. When he headed for the door, I rolled out of his way. He was big enough to simply crush my chest if he stepped on me, but I didn't want to make it easy for him.
"You got lucky," the ogre growled, "but this is not over."
Then his form blurred and shifted, growing smaller, until he wore the same appearance he had a few moments before. He settled his bowler with one hand, then stalked out the door, aiming a kick at me in passing. I cringed away from it, and he was gone.
"What's it gonna be, you fruit? Get out!"
Police sirens wailed somewhere outside. I got up, wobbled for a moment, and put my hand against the wall to help myself stay up. I turned the other hand over to look at the piece of paper I'd stolen from Grum's satchel. It wasn't paper, it was a photograph. Nothing fancy, just an instant camera shot. It showed old white-haired Rule standing in front of the magic castle at one of the Disney parks. Several young people stood beside him and around him, smiling, sunburned, and apparently happy. One was a tall, bull-necked young woman in faded jeans, with her hair dyed a shade of muddy green. She had a wide smile and a blunt, ugly face. Standing beside her was a girl who should have been in a lingerie catalog, all curves and long limbs in her brief shorts and bikini top, her hair also green, but the color of summer grass rather than that of pond scum. On the other side of Rule was a pair of young men. One of them, a short, stocky fellow with a goatee and sunglasses, had his fingers lifted into a V behind the head of his companion, a small, slender man, with his skin sunburned to the color of copper and his blonde hair bleached out to nearly white. Who were they? Why had Rule been with them? And why had Grum seemed so intent on removing their picture from Rule's apartment? The sirens got closer. And if I didn't want to get locked up by some well-meaning member of Chicago's finest, I needed to leave. I rubbed at my aching throat, winced at the retching, cramping pain in my back, wondered about the photograph, and stumbled out of the building. Chapter 12. I got out of the old apartment building and back to the Blue Beetle without being mugged by any attackers, inhuman or otherwise. I pulled out. A patrol car rolled up, blue bubbles flashing. I drove away at a sedate pace and tried to keep my shaking hands from making the car bob or swerve. No one pulled me over, so I must have done all right. Score one for the good guys. I had time to think, but I wasn't sure I wanted to. I'd gone to Rule's apartment on a simple snoop, not really expecting to find much, if anything. But I'd gotten lucky. Not only had I shown up at the right place, I'd done it at the right time. Someone obviously wanted to hide something there. Either more pictures like the one I'd found or other papers from somewhere in the place. What I needed to determine now was what Grum had been trying to collect. Or nearly as good, why he was trying to make some kind of evidence vanish. Failing that, knowing who he was working for would do almost as well. Ogres aren't exactly known for their independent initiative. And given what was going on, it would be ludicrous to assume that one of the heavyweight thugs of the lands of Faerie just happened to be doing an independent contract in the home of the recently deceased. Ogres were wild fae, and they would work for either winter or summer, and they could have a range of personalities and temperaments running the gambit from jovially violent to maliciously violent. Grum hadn't seemed to be on the cheerful end of that particular scale, but he had been both decisive and restrained. The average walking mountain of muscle from Faerie wouldn't have held back from beating me to a pulp, regardless of what the neighbors shouted. That meant that Grum had more savvy than the average bear, that he was dangerous, even if I didn't take into account how easily he had ignored the spells I'd hurled at him. All ogres had the innate capacity for neutralizing magical forces to one degree or another. Grum had grounded out my spells like I'd been scuffing my feet on the carpet to give him a little static electricity zap. That meant that he was an old fairy, and a strong one. The quick and thorough shape-shifting supported that assessment as well. Your average club-swinging thumonger couldn't have taken human form, complete with clothing, so ably. Smart plus strong plus quick equals badass. Most likely he was a trusted personal guard or highly placed enforcer. But for whom? At a stoplight, I stared at the photograph I'd taken from Grum. Damn, I muttered, who are these people? I added it to the list of questions, still growing like fungus in a locker room. Ronald Rule's funeral had already begun by the time I arrived. Flannery's funeral home in the River North area had been a family-run business until a few years before. It was an old place, but had always been well-kept. Now the carefully landscaped shrubbery had been replaced with big rocks, which were no doubt easier to maintain. The parking lot had a lot of cracks in it, and only about half of the outdoor lights were burning. The sign, an illuminated glass and plastic number that read Quiet Acres Funeral Home, glared in garish green and blue above the front door. I parked the Beetle, tucked the photo into my pocket, and got out of the car. I couldn't casually take my staff or my blasting rod into the funeral home. People who don't believe in magic look at you oddly when you walk in toting a big stick covered with carvings of runes and sigils. The people who know who I am would react in much the same way, as if I'd walked in draped in belts of ammo and carrying a heavy-caliber machine gun in each hand, John Wayne style. There could be plenty of each sort inside, so I carried only the low-profile stuff, my ring, mostly depleted, my shield bracelet, and my mother's silver pentacle amulet. My reflection in the glass door reminded me that I'd underdressed for the evening, but I wasn't there to make a social column. I slipped into the building and headed for the room where they'd laid out Ronald Rule. The old man had been dressed up in a gray silk suit with a metallic sheen to it. It was a younger man's suit, and it looked too big for him. He would have looked more comfortable in tweed. The mortician had done only a so-so job of fixing Rule up. His cheeks were too red, his lips too blue. You could see the dimples on his lips where the thin lines of thread had been stitched through them to hold his mouth closed. No one would have mistaken this for an old man in the midst of his nap. It was a corpse, plain and simple. The room was about half full, people standing in little knots, talking and passing back and forth in front of the casket. No one was standing in the shadows, smoking a cigarette or looking about with a shifty-eyed gaze. I couldn't see anyone hiding quietly a bloody knife behind his back or twirling a mustache either. That ruled out the Dudley Do-Right approach to finding the killer. Maybe he, or she, or they, weren't here. Of course, I supposed it would have been possible for fairies to throw a veil or glamour over themselves before they came in, but even experienced fairies have trouble passing for mortal. Mab had looked good, sure, but she hadn't really looked normal. Grum had been much the same. I mean, he looked human, sure, but also like an extra on the set of The Untouchables. Fairies can do a lot of things really well, but blending in with a crowd generally isn't one of them. In any case, the crowd struck me as mostly relatives and business associates. No one matched the pictures. No one seemed to be a fairy in a bad mortal costume. And either my instincts had the night off, or no one was using any kind of veil or glamour. Bad guys 1, Harry 0. I stepped out of the viewing room and back into the hallway in time to hear a low whisper somewhere down the hall. That grabbed my attention. I made the effort to move quietly and crept a bit closer, listening as I went. "I don't know," hissed a male voice. "I looked for her all day. She's never been gone this long." "Just my point," growled a female voice. "She doesn't stay gone this long. You know how she gets by herself."
"God," said a third voice, a light tenor of a young man. "He did it. He really did it this time."
"We don't know that," the first man said. "Maybe she finally used her head and got out of town."
The woman's voice sounded tired.
"No, Ace. She wouldn't just leave. Not on her own. We have to do something."
"But what can we do?" the second male voice said.
"Something," the woman said. "Anything."
"Wow, that's specific," the first male, apparently Ace, said with his voice dry and edgy.
"Whatever you're going to do, you'd better do it fast. The wizard is here."
I felt the muscles in my neck grow tense. There was a short, perhaps shocked silence in the room down the hall.
"Here?"
the second male echoed in a panicky tone.
"Now? Why didn't you tell us?"
"I just did, dimwit," Ace said.
"But what should we do?"
the second male asked.
"What do we do? What do we do?"
"Shut up," snapped the female voice.
"Shut up, Fix."
"He's in Mab's pocket," said Ace. "You know he is. She crossed over from Ferry today."
"No way,"
said the second voice, presumably Fix.
"He's supposed to be a decent sort, right?"
"Depends on who you hear it from," said Ace. "People who get in his way have a habit of getting real dead."
"God," said Fix, panting. "Oh, God. Oh, God."
"Look," said the woman. "If he's here, we shouldn't be. Not until we know what it means." Furniture, maybe wooden chair, creaked. "Come on."
I slipped back down the hall and around the corner into the lobby as I heard footsteps leaving the small side room. They didn't come toward me. Instead, they moved further down the hall, away from the lobby. They had to be heading for a back door. I chewed on my lip and weighed my options. 3 very apprehensive folk, maybe human, maybe not, heading down a darkened hall toward a back door that doubtless led to an equally dark alley. It sounded like a recipe for more trouble. But I didn't think I had any options. I counted to 5 and followed the footsteps. I saw only a retreating shadow at the far end of the hall. I looked into the room the 3 had been in as I walked past it and found a small lounge with several upholstered chairs. I hesitated for a moment at the corner and heard the soft click of a metal door opening, then closing. As I rounded the corner, I saw a door with a faded sticker spelling exit. I went to the door and opened it as quietly as I could, then poked my head out into the alley it opened into and rubbernecked around. They were standing not 5 feet away, 3 of the people from Rule's photo. The small, skinny man with the blonde white hair and dark tan was facing me. He was dressed in what looked like a second-hand brown suit and a yellow polyester clip-on tie. His eyes widened almost comically, and his mouth dropped open in shock. He squeaked, and it was enough to let me identify him as Fix. Beside him was another young man, Ace. He was the one with dark, curly hair and a goatee, wearing a gray sport coat with a white shirt and dark slacks. He still had his sunglasses on when he turned to look at me, and he clawed at the pocket of his jacket upon seeing me. The third was a brawny, homely young woman with the muddy green hair and heavy brow. She had on a pair of jeans, tight enough to show the muscles in her thighs, and a khaki blouse. She didn't hesitate. She didn't even look. She just turned, her arm sweeping out as she did, and fetched me a blow to my cheek with the back of her shovel-sized hand. I managed to move with it a bit on the last second, but even so, the impact threw me out of the doorway and into the alley. Stars and cartoon birdies danced in my vision, and I rolled, trying to get clear before she could hit me again. Ace pulled out a small-caliber semi-automatic from his jacket pocket, but the woman growled at him, "Don't be stupid! They'll kill us all!" "Hebbity bille," I said by way of attempting a greeting. My mouth had gone rather numb, and my tongue felt like a lead weight.
"Just hang on a second."
Fix jumped up and down, pointing at me, his voice shrill.
"He's casting on us!"
The woman kicked me in the ribs hard enough to knock the wind out of me. Then she picked me up by the back of my pants, grunting with the effort, and threw me into the air. I came down 10 feet away in an open dumpster and crunched down amid cardboard boxes and stinking refuse.
"Go!"
the woman barked. "Go! Go! Go!" I lay in the garbage for a minute, trying to catch my breath. The sound of three sets of feet receded down the alley. I had just sat up when a head popped into view over me, vague in the shadows. I flinched and threw up my left arm, willing power through the shield bracelet. I accidentally made the shield too big, and sparks kicked up where the shield intersected the metal of the dumpster. But by their light, I saw whose head it was.
"Harry?" Billy the werewolf asked. "What are you doing in there?"
I let the shield drop and extended a hand to him.
"Looking for suspects."
He frowned and hauled me out of the trash. I wobbled for a second or two until my head stopped spinning quite so quickly. Billy steadied me with one hand. "You find any?"
"I'd say so, yeah."
Billy nodded and peered up at me.
"Did you decide that before or after they hit you in the face and threw you in the garbage?"
I brushed coffee grounds off my jeans.
"Do I tell you how to do your job?"
"Actually, yeah, all the time."
"Okay, okay," I muttered.
"Did you bring the pizza?"
"Yeah,"
Billy said.
"Got it back in the car. Why?"
I brushed at my shaggy hair. What I hoped was more coffee grounds fell out. I started walking down the alley toward the front of the building.
"Because I need to make a few bribes," I said, looking back over my shoulder at Billy. "Do you believe in fairies?"
Chapter 13. Billy held the pizza while I drew the chalk circle on the ground back in the alley.
"Harry," he said, "how is this supposed to work exactly?"
"Hang on," I said. I didn't quite complete the circle, but took the pizza box from him. I opened it, took out one piece, and put it down in the middle of the circle on a napkin. Then I dabbed a bit of blood from the corner of my mouth where the girl had slugged me onto the bottom of the piece of pizza, stepped back, and completed the circle without willing it closed.
"Pretty simple," I said. "I call the fairy in close to the pizza here. He'll smell it, jump on it, eat it. When he does, he'll get a bit of my blood, and it'll be enough to close the circle around him."
"Uh-huh,"
Billy said, his expression skeptical. He took out a second piece of pizza and started to take a bite.
"And then you beat the information out of him?"
I took the piece out of his hand, put it back in the box, and closed it. "And then I bribed the information out of him. Save the pizza." Billy scowled at me, but he left the pizza alone.
"So what do?"
"Sit tight and make sure no one else tries to pop me while I'm talking to Toot Toot."
"Toot Toot?"
Billy asked, lifting an eyebrow. "Hell, spells, Billy. I didn't pick the name. Just be quiet. If he thinks there are mortals around, he'll get nervous and leave before I can snare him."
"If you say so," Billy said. "I was just hoping to do more good than deliver pizza."
I raked my fingers through my hair.
"I don't know what you could do yet. I could track those three in the picture you showed me."
I shook my head.
"Odds are they just got into a car and left."
"Yeah," he said, some forced patience in his voice.
"But if I get their scent now, it might help me to find them later on."
"Oh," I said, feeling a bit stupid. Okay, so I hadn't considered the whole shape-shifting angle.
"Fine, if you want to. Just be careful, all right? I don't know what all might be prowling around."
"Okay, Mom," Billy said. He set the pizza box on top of a closed trash can, fell back down the alley, and vanished. I waited until Billy had gone to find a nice patch of shadows to step into. Then I closed my eyes for a moment, drawing up my concentration, and began to whisper the fairy's name. Every intelligent being has a name, a specific series of spoken sounds linked to its very being. If a practitioner knows the name of something, knows it in every nuance and detail of pronunciation, he can use that name to open a magical conduit to that being. That's how demons get summoned to the mortal world. Call something's name, and you make contact with it. And if you're a wizard, that means that you can then exercise power over it, no matter where in the world it is. Controlling an inhuman being via its name is a shady area of magic, only one step removed from taking over the will of another mortal. According to the White Council's 7 laws of magic, that's a capital crime, and they make zero-tolerance policies look positively lenient. Given how much the Council loves me, I'm a tad paranoid about breaking any of the laws of magic, so while I was calling the fairy's name, I put only the tiniest trickle of compulsion into it. Just enough to attract his unconscious attention, to make him curious about what might be down this particular alley. I whispered the fairy's name and stood in the shadows, waiting. Maybe 10 minutes later, something made from a hummingbird and a falling star spiraled down from overhead, a flickering ball of blue-white light. It alighted on the ground, the light dimming to a luminous sheen over the form of a tiny fairy. Toot, toot. Toot stood about 6 inches tall. He had a mane of dandelion fluff hair, the color of lilacs, and a pair of translucent dragonfly wings rising from his shoulders. Otherwise, he looked almost human, his beauty a distant echo of the lords of Fairy, the She. On his head he wore what looked like a plastic Coke bottle cap. It was tied into place with a piece of string that ran under his chin, and his lilac hair squeezed out from beneath it all the way around, all but hiding his eyes. In one hand he carried a spear, fashioned from a battered old No. 2 pencil, some twine, and what must have been a straight pin, and he wore a little blue plastic cocktail sword through another piece of twine on his belt. Toot landed in a cautious crouch near the pizza, as though streaking in like an errant shot from a Roman candle might not have alerted anyone watching to his presence. He tiptoed in a big circle around the pizza and made a show of looking all around, one hand lifted to shade his eyes. Then he raised his arm and balled up a tiny fist and pumped it up and down a few times. Immediately, 6 similar streaks of glowing color darted down out of the air, each one a different color, each one containing a tiny fairy at its center. They alighted more or less together, and every one of them was armed with a weapon that might have been cobbled together from the contents of a child's schoolbox. "Captain," Toot Toot piped in a shrill voice, "report!" A green-lit fairy beside Toot snapped to attention and slapped herself on the forehead with one hand, then turned sharply to her left and barked, "Lieutenant, report!" A purple-hued fairy came to attention as well and smacked himself in the head with one hand, then turned to the next fairy beside him and snapped, "Star Zump, report!" And so it went down the line through Corpse Oral and First Class Privil, and finally to Second Class Privil, who marched up to Toot Toot and said, "Everyone's here, Generous, and we're hungry." "All right," Toot Toot barked. "Everyone fall apart for Messy." And with that, the fairies let out shrill hoots of glee, tossed aside their weapons and armaments, and threw themselves upon the piece of pizza. As soon as the little fairies started eating, the magic circle snapped closed around them with a hardly audible pop as it sprang into place. The effect was immediate. The fairies let out 6 piercing shrieks of alarm and buzzed into the air, smacking into the invisible wall of the circle here and there, sending out puffs of glowing dust motes when they did. They fell into a panicked spiral around the inside of the circle until Toot Toot landed on the ground, looked up at the other fairies, and started shouting, 10 huts! 10 huts! The other fairies abruptly came to a complete stop in the air, standing rigidly straight. Evidently, they couldn't do that and keep their little wings going at the same time, because they promptly fell to the alley floor, landing with 6 separate ouches and as many puffs of glowing fairy dust. Toot Toot recovered his pencil spear and stood at the very edge of the closed circle, peering out at the alley. "Harry Dresden? Is that you?" I stepped out from my hiding spot and nodded. "It's me. How you doing, Toot?" I expected a torrent of outraged but empty threats. That was Toot Toot's usual procedure. Instead, he let out a hiss and crouched down in the circle, spear at the ready. The other little fairies took up their own weapons and rushed to Toot Toot's side.
"You can't make us," Toot said. "We haven't been called, and until we are, we belong to ourselves."
I blinked down at him. "Called? Toot, what are you talking about?"
"We're not stupid, emissary," Toot Toot said. "I know what you are. I could smell the cold queen all over you."
I wondered if they made a deodorant for that. I lifted my hand in a placating gesture.
"Toot, I'm working for Mab right now, but it's just another client, okay? I'm not here to take you anywhere or make you do anything."
Toot planted the eraser end of his spear on the ground, scowling suspiciously up at me.
"Really?" he demanded.
"Really," I said.
"Promise?"
"Promise."
"Super-duper double-dog promise spit swear?"
I nodded. "Super-duper double-dog promise spit swear," I repeated gravely.
"Spit!"
Toot demanded. I spat on the ground.
"Oh, well then,"
Toot said. He dropped his spear and darted over to the pizza, much to the consternation of the other little fairies, who let out piping shrills of protest and then followed him. The piece of pizza didn't last long. It was like watching one of those nature shows where the piranha devour some luckless thing that falls into the water, except here there were glittering wings and motes and puffs of glowing, colorful dust everywhere. I watched, frowning, until Toot Toot flopped onto his back, his tummy slightly distended. He let out a contented sigh, and the other fairies followed suit.
"So, Harry," Toot said, "who do you think is going to win the war?"
"The White Council," I said. "The Red Court's got no depth on the bench and nothing in the bullpen." Toot snorted and flipped his plastic bottle cap helm off his head. His hair waved around in the breeze.
"Just because they don't have any cows doesn't mean that they won't win. But I don't mean that war,"
I frowned. "You mean between the courts?" Toot nodded.
"Yeah."
"Okay. What's with the armor and weapons, Toot?" The fairy beamed.
"Neat, huh?"
"Hugely scary," I said gravely. "But why do you have them?" Toot folded his arms and said, with all the gravity that 6 inches of fluff and pixie dust can muster,
"Trouble's coming."
"Uh-huh. I hear the courts are upset."
"More than just upset, Harry Dresden. The drawing of the wild fae is beginning. I saw some dryads walking with a she knight from summer, and a canal nereid climbed out of the water a couple of blocks over and went into a winter building."
"Drawing of the wild fae? Like you guys?" Toot nodded and propped his feet up on the legs of Star Jump, who let out a surprisingly basso belch.
"Not everybody plays with the courts. We mostly just do our job and don't pay attention. But when there's a war on, the wild fae get called to one side or another."
"Who picks which way you go?"
Toot shrugged. "Mostly the nice wild fae go to the warm queen, and the mean ones go to the cold. I think it's got something to do with what you've been doing."
"Uh-huh. So, have you been doing warm or cold things?" Toot let out a sparkling laugh.
"How could I remember all those things?"
He patted his stomach and rose to his feet again, eyes calculating.
"Is that a pizza box you have there, Harry?"
I held the box out and opened it, showing the rest of the pizza. There was a collective "ooh" from the fairies, and they all pressed to the very edge of the circle until it flattened their little noses, staring at the pizza in fascinated lust.
"You've sure given us a lot of pizza the past couple of years, Harry,"
Toot said with a swallow. He didn't look away from the box in my hands. "Hey, you gave me a hand when I needed it," I said. "It's only fair, right?"
"Only fair?" Toot spat, outraged. It's pizza, Harry."
"I'm wanting some more work done," I said. "I need information."
"And you're paying in pizza?"
Toot asked, his tone hopeful.
"Yes," I said. "Wahoo!"
Toot shouted and buzzed into the air in an excited spiral. The other fairies followed him with similar chorals of happiness, and the blur of colors was dizzying.
"Give us the pizza!"
Toot shouted.
"Pizza! Pizza! Pizza!"
the other fairies shrilled. "First," I said, "I want some questions answered."
"Right, right, right," Toot screamed. "Ask already!"
"I need to talk to the Winter Lady," I said. "Where can I find her, Toot?" Toot tore at his lavender hair.
"Is that all you need to know? Down in the city, down where the shops are underground and the sidewalks."
I frowned. "In the commuter tunnels?"
Yes, yes, yes. Back in the part the mortals can't see, you can find your way into Undertown. The cold lady came to Undertown. Her court is in Undertown. What? I sputtered. Since when?
Toot whirled around in impatient loops in the air.
Since the last autumn!
I scratched at my hair. It made sense, I suppose. Last autumn, a vengeful vampire and her allies had stirred up all sorts of supernatural mischief, creating turbulence in the border between the real world and the never-never, the world of spirit. Shortly after, the war between the wizards and the vampires had begun. Those events had probably attracted the attention of all sorts of things. I shook my head.
And what about the summer lady? Is she in town?
Toot put his fists on his hips.
Well, obviously, Harry. If winter came here, summer had to come too, didn't it?
Obviously, I said, feeling a little slow on the uptake. Man, I was off my game. Where can I find her?
She's on top of one of those big buildings, I sighed.
Toot, this is Chicago. There's a lot of big buildings. Toot blinked at me, then frowned for a minute before brightening.
It's the one with the pizza shop right by it.
My head hurt some more. Tell you what, how about you guide me to it? Toot thrust out his little chin and scowled.
And Miss Pizza? No way.
I gritted my teeth.
Then get me someone else to guide me. You've got to know someone.
Toot scrunched up his face. He tugged at one earlobe, but it evidently didn't help him remember, because he had to rub one foot against the opposite calf and spin around in vacant circles for 10 whole seconds before he whirled back to face me, the nimbus of light around him brightening.
Aha! He sang. Yes, I can give you a guide.
He jabbed a finger at me.
But only if that's all the questions, Harry. Pizza, pizza, pizza!
Guide first, I insisted, then pizza. Toot shook his arms and legs as though he would fly apart.
Yes, yes, yes!
Done, I said. I opened the pizza box and set it on top of the discarded crate nearby. Then I stepped over to the circle, leaned down, and with a smudge of my hand and an effort of will, broke it, freeing the energies inside. The fairies chorused several pitches and variants of Yahoo! And streaked past me so quickly that they left a cone of wild air behind them, tossing my unruly hair and scattering lighter pieces of garbage around the alley. They tore into the pizza with much the same gusto they'd used on the one piece earlier, but there was enough of it now to keep them from mangling it in mere seconds. Toot zipped over to hover in front of my face and held out his little palm. A moment later, something that looked like an errant spark from a campfire whirled down and lighted on his palm. Toot said something in a language I couldn't understand, and the tiny light pulsed and flickered as though in response.
Right,
Toot said, nodding to the light. I peered more closely at it and could just barely make out a tiny, tiny form inside, no larger than an ant. Another fairy. The light pulsed and flickered, and Toot nodded to it before turning to me.
Harry Dresden, Toot said, holding out his palm. This is Elodie. She's going to pay me back a favor to guide you to the Winter Lady and then to the Summer Lady. Good enough?
I frowned at the tiny fairy. Does she understand me? I barely saw Elodie stamp a tiny foot. The scarlet light around her flickered sharply twice.
Yes, Toot translated. Two lights for yes and one light for no.
Two for yes, one for no, I muttered. Toot frowned.
Or is that one for yes and two for no? I can never keep it straight.
And with that, the little fairy blurred and zipped past me and away to join the swarm of softly flashing lights demolishing the pizza. Elodie, for her part, recovered from the miniature cyclone that Tutu left in his wake, whirled around dizzily for a few moments, then spiraled down to me and settled on the bridge of my nose. My eyes crossed, trying to look at her.
Hey, I said. Do I look like a couch to you?
Two flashes. I sighed.
Okay, Elodie, do you want any pizza before we go?
Two flashes again, brighter. The tiny fairy leapt up into the air again and zoomed over to the cloud around the pizza. Footsteps came down the alley. Then Billy stepped out of the shadows, pulling his sweatshirt down over his muscular stomach. I had a brief and irrational surge of jealousy. I don't have a muscular stomach. I'm not overlapping my belt or anything, but I don't have abs of steel. I don't even have abs of bronze. Maybe abs of plastic. Billy blinked at the pizza for a moment and said, "Wow, that's sort of pretty, in a Jaws kind of way." Yeah, I said. Don't look at it for too long. Fairy lights can be disorienting to mortals. Gotcha, Billy said, and he glanced back at me. How'd it go? You get what you needed?
Yeah, I said. You?
He shrugged. Alley isn't the best place to pick up scents, but I should be able to recognize them again if I'm in my other suit. They didn't smell quite normal.
Gee, what are the odds?
Billy's teeth showed in the dark.
So what are we waiting for?
Elodie picked just then to glide back over to me and settle once more on the bridge of my nose. Billy blinked at her and said,
What the hell?
This is our guide, I said. Elodie, this is Billy. Elodie flashed twice. Billy blinked again.
Charmed,
he shook his head. So what's the plan?
We go confront the Winter Lady in her underground lair. I do the talking. You stay alert and watch my back.
He nodded. Okay, got it. I looked over to see the last piece of pizza lifted up into the air by greedy fairy hands. They clustered around it, tearing and ripping, and it was gone in seconds. With that, the fairies swarmed away like a squadron of pot-bellied comets and vanished from view. Elodie fluttered off my nose and started drifting down the alleyway in the other direction. I followed her.
Harry?
Billy asked, his voice a touch hopeful. Are we expecting trouble? I sighed and rubbed at the place between my eyebrows.
Definitely getting a headache. It was going to be a long night.
Chapter 14. Elodie led Billy and me through alleyways, up a fire escape to the roof of a building, and then down the other side, and then through a junk-cluttered abandoned lot on the way to the pedway. It took us better than half an hour of scrambling after the tiny fairy through the muggy heat, and by the end of it I'd wished I'd told Toot Toot that we wanted someone who could read a street map and guide us there in a car. Chicago's commuter tunnels are a fairly recent construction compared to much of the rest of the city. The tunnels are a maze if you don't know them. Long stretches of identical overhead lights, drab, clean walls dotted with advertising posters, and intersections bearing plain and not always helpful directional signs. The tunnels closed after the workday and wouldn't open again until around 6 the next morning, but Elodie led us to an unfinished building at Randolph and Wabash. She flitted around in front of the service door that proved to be unlocked and that led down to a similar door that opened onto a darkened section of the pedway that looked as though it had been under construction but was abandoned when the building had been shut down. It was completely dark, so I slipped the silver pentacle off my neck, lifting it in my hand and focusing a quiet effort of will upon it. The five-pointed star has been a symbol of magic for centuries, representing the four elements of the power of spirit bound within the circle of will, primal power under the control of human thought. I held the pentacle before me, and as I concentrated, it began to glow with a gentle blue light, illumining enough of our surroundings that we could navigate through the dark, silent tunnels. The little fairy drifted in front of us down the tunnel, and we followed her without speaking. She took us to the intersection with the main tunnels of the pedway, and on a brief walk down another tunnel, to a section shut behind a rusting metal gate with a sign that read, Danger, Keep Out. The gate proved to be unlocked, and we went down the tunnel into a damper section of the tunnels, rife with the smells of mold that was clearly not part of the pedway proper. After another 50 or 60 feet, we reached a place where the walls became rough and uneven, and shadows lay thick and heavy, despite the glow of my wizard's light. Elodie drifted over to an especially dark section of the wall and flew in a little circle in front of it.
Okay, I said. I guess this is where we get in.
What is where we get in? Billy asked, his voice skeptical. Get into where?
Undertown, I said.
I ran my hands over the wall. To the casual touch, it appeared to be bare, unfinished concrete, but I felt a slight unsteadiness when I pressed against it. It couldn't have been solid stone.
There must be a panel here somewhere. Trigger of some kind.
What do you mean, under town? Never heard of it before.
I was probably working here for 5 or 6 years before I did, I said. You have to understand the history of Chicago, how they did things here.
Billy folded his arms.
I'm listening.
The city is a swamp, I said, still searching for a means of opening the door with my fingertips. We're darn near level with Lake Michigan. When they first built this place, the town kept sinking into the muck. I mean, every year it sank lower. They used to build streets, then build a latticework of wood over them, and then another street on top of that, planning on them slowly sinking. They planned houses the same way, built the front door on the second floor, and called it a Chicago entry, so when the house sank, the front door would be at ground level. What about when the street sank? Build another one on top of it, so you wound up with a whole city existing under the street level. They used to have a huge problem with rats and criminals holed up under the streets.
But not anymore? Billy asked.
The rats and thugs mostly got crowded out by other things. Became a whole miniature civilization down here. It was out of sight of the sun, which made it a friendly space for all the night-crawling critters around.
Hence, undertown, Billy said. I nodded. Undertown. There's a lot of tunnels around Chicago. The Manhattan Project was housed in them for a while during World War II.
Did all that atomic bomb research.
Why, that's cheerful. You come down here a lot?
I shook my head. Hell no. All kinds of nastiness lives down here. Billy frowned at me.
Like what?
Lots of things. Stuff you don't often see on the surface. Things even wizards know almost nothing about. Goblins, spirits of the earth, Wyrms, things that have no name. Plus the usual riffraff. Vampires sometimes find lairs down here during the day. Trolls can hide here, too. Molds and fungi you don't get in most of the natural world. You name it. Billy pursed his lips thoughtfully.
So you're taking us into a maze of lightless, rotting, precarious tunnels full of evil fairies and monsters.
I nodded.
Maybe leftover radiation, too. God, you're a fun guy, Harry.
My fingers found a tiny groove in the wall, and when I pressed against it, a small flat section of stone clicked and retracted. The switch had to have triggered some kind of release because the section of wall pivoted in the center, turning outward and forming a door that led into still more dank darkness.
Ha, I said with some satisfaction. There we go.
Billy pressed forward and tried to step through the door, but I put a hand on his shoulder and stopped him.
Hang on. There are some things you need to know.
Billy frowned, but he stopped, listening.
These are fairies. We'll probably run into a lot of the she, their nobles, hanging out with the Winter Lady. That means they're going to be dangerous, and will probably try to entrap you.
What do you mean, entrap me? Billy said.
Bargains, I said. Deals. They'll try to offer you things, get you to trade one thing for another.
Why?
I shook my head. I don't know. It's in their nature. The concept of debt and obligation is a huge factor in how they behave.
Billy lifted his eyebrows.
That's why that little guy worked for you, right? Because he owed you for the pizza and he had a debt to you.
Right, I said. But it can work both ways. If you owe them something, they have a conduit to you and can use magic against you. The basic rule is not to accept any gifts from them. And for God's sake, don't offer them any gifts. They find anything other than an equal exchange to be either enticing or insulting. It isn't a big deal with the little guys like Toot, but if you get into it with a she-lord, you might not live through it.
Billy shrugged. Okay, no gifts. Dangerous fairies. Got it.
I'm not finished. They aren't going to be offering you wrapped packages, man. These are the she. They're some of the most beautiful creatures there are, and they'll try to put you off balance and tempt you.
Tempt me? Like with sex? Is that what you're saying?
Like any kind of sensual indulgence. Sex, food, beauty, music, perfume. When they offer, don't accept it, or you'll be opening yourself up to a world of hurt.
Billy nodded. Okay, got it. Let's go already.
I eyed the younger man, and he gave me an impatient look. I shook my head. I don't think I could have adequately conveyed the kind of danger we might be walking into with mere words in any case. I took a deep breath and then nodded to Elodie.
All right, Tinkerbell, let's go.
The tiny scarlet light gave an irritated bob and then darted through the concealed doorway and into the darkness beyond. Billy narrowed his eyes and followed it, and I went after him. We found ourselves in a tunnel where one wall seemed to be made of ancient, moldering brick, and the other of a mixture of rotting wood beams, loose earth, and winding roots. The tunnel ran on, out of the circle of light from my amulet. Our guide drifted forward, and we set out to follow her, walking close together. The tunnel gave way to a sort of low-roofed cavern, supported here and there by pillars, mounds of collapsed earth, and beams that looked like they'd been added in afterward by the dwellers of Undertown. Elodie circled in place a bit uncertainly and then started floating to the right. I hadn't been following the little fairy for 5 seconds before the skin on the back of my neck tried to crawl up over my head and hide my mouth. I drew up short, and I must have made some kind of noise because Billy shot a look back at me and asked, "Harry, what is it?" I lifted a hand to silence him and peered into the darkness around me. "Keep your eyes open," I said. "I don't think we're alone." From the shadows outside the light came a low, hissing sound. The rest of my skin erupted in goose flesh, and I shook my shield bracelet clear. I lifted my voice and said clearly, "I am the wizard Dresden, emissary of the Winter Court, bound to pay a call upon the Winter Lady. I've no time or desire for a fight. Stand clear, and let me pass." A voice. A voice that sounded like a tortured cat might, if some demented being gave it the gift of speech, mewled out of the shadows, grating on my ears.
"We know who you are, wizard,"
the voice said. Its inflections were all wrong, and the tone seemed to come from not far above the ground, somewhere off to my right. Elodie let out a high-pitched shriek of terror and zipped back to me, diving into my hair. I felt the warmth of the light around the tiny fairy like a patch of sunlight on my scalp. I traded a look with Billy and turned toward the source of the voice. "Who are you?"
"A servant of the Winter Lady,"
the voice replied from directly behind me.
"Sent here to guide you safely through this realm and to her court."
I turned in the other direction and peered more closely toward the sound of the voice. The werelight from my amulet suddenly gleamed off a pair of animal eyes, 20 feet away and a few inches from the floor. I looked back at Billy. He'd already noted the eyes and turned to put his back to mine, watching the darkness behind us. I turned back to the speaker and said, "I ask again, who are you?" The eyes shifted in place. The voice let out an angry, growling sound.
"Many names I am called, and many paths I have trod. Hunter I have been, and watcher, and guide. My lady sent me to bring you thither, safe and whole and well."
"Don't get mad at me, Charlie," I snapped. "You know the drill as well as I do. Thrice I ask and done. Who are you?"
The voice came out harsh and sullen, barely intelligible.
"Grey Malkin, I am called by the cold lady, who bids me guide her mother's emissary with safe conduct to her court and her throne."
I let out a breath. "All right," I said. "So lead us." The eyes bobbed in place as though in a small bow, and Grey Malkin mewled again. There was a faint motion in the shadows outside my light, and then a dull greenish glow appeared upon the ground. I stepped toward it and found a faint, luminous footprint upon the ground. A vague paw, feline, but too spread out and too thin to be an actual cat's. Just as I reached it, another light appeared on the floor, several feet away.
"Make haste, wizard,"
mewled Grimalkin's voice.
"Make haste. The lady waits. The season passes. Time is short."
I moved toward the second footprint, and as I reached it, a third appeared before us in the dark, and so on.
"What was that all about?" Billy murmured. "Asking it the same thing 3 times, I mean."
"It's a binding," I murmured in reply. "Fairies aren't allowed to speak a lie. And if a fairy says something 3 times, it has to be sure that it's true. It's bound to fulfill a promise spoken thrice."
"Ah," Billy said. "So even if this thing hadn't actually been sent to guide it safely, making him say so 3 times would mean he's obliged to do it."
"Got it." I shook my head. I wanted to make sure Grey Malkin was on the level, but they hate being bound like that. From above us, the faintly glowing eyes appeared briefly, accompanied by another mewling sound that sent a chill down my spine.
"Oh," Billy said. He didn't look any too calm himself. His face had gone a little pale, and he walked with his hands clenched into fists.
"So, if Grey Malkin had good intentions to begin with, wouldn't that make him angry that you needlessly bound him?" I shrugged. I'm not here to make friends, Billy. I'm here to find a killer. You've never even heard of diplomacy, have you? We followed the trail of footlights on the ground for another 20 minutes or so through damp tunnels, sometimes only a few feet high. More sections of the tunnel showed evidence of recent construction, if you could call swirling layers of stone that seemed to have been smoothed into place like soft-serve ice cream construction. We passed several tunnels that seemed entirely new. Whatever beings lived down here, they didn't seem to be too shy about expanding. "How much further?" I asked. Grimalkin let out a rolling sound from somewhere nearby, not in the direction of the next footprint either.
"Very near, noble emissary. Very near now."
The unseen fairy guide was good to its word. At the next glowing footprint, no other appeared. Instead, we came to a large, elaborately carved double doorway made of some black wood I could not identify. The doors were 8 or 9 feet high and carved in a rich bas-relief. At first, I thought the carvings were of a garden theme. Leaves, vines, flowers, fruit, that kind of thing. But as I walked closer to the door, I could see more detail in the light of my glowing amulet. The forms of people lay among the vines. Some sprawled amorously together, while others were nothing more than skeletons, wrapped in creeping roses, or corpses, staring with sightless eyes from within a bed of poppies. Here and there in the garden, one could see evidence of the she, a pair of eyes, a veiled figure, and their hangers-on, the little fairies like Toot Toot, leaf-clad dryads, pipe-wielding satyrs, and many, many others hiding from the mortals' views, dancing. "Nice digs," Billy commented. "Is this the place?" I glanced around for our guide, but I didn't see any more footprints or feline eyes. "I guess it must be. They aren't exactly subtle, are they? Well, summer's better at it than winter, but they can all be when it suits them." "Uh-huh. You know what bothers me, Harry?"
"What?"
"Grimalkin never said he'd guide us out again." I glanced back at Billy. Quiet, hissing laughter came out of the darkness, directionless. I took a deep breath. "Steady, Harry. Don't let the kids see you get nervous." Then I turned to the door and struck it solidly with my fist 3 times. The blows rang out, hollow and booming. Silence fell on the tunnels for a long moment, until the doors split down the middle and let out from behind them a flood of light and sound and color. Silence fell on the tunnels for a long moment, until the doors split down the middle and let out from behind them a flood of light and sound and color. I didn't know what to expect from the Winter Court, but it wasn't big band music. A large brass section blared from somewhere behind the doors, and drums rattled and pounded with a rough, genuine sound of actual skins. The lights were colored and muted, as if the whole place was lit by Christmas strands, and I could see shadows whirling and moving inside. Dancers. "Careful," I muttered. "Don't let the music get to you." I stepped up to the great doors and passed through them. The room could have come from a roaring 20s hotel. Hell, it might have been, if the hotel had sunk into the earth, turned slightly upon its side, and been decorated by things with no concept of human values. Whatever it had been, it had always been meant for dancing. The dance floor was made of blocks of rose-colored marble, and even though the floor was tilted, the blocks had been slipped to the level here and there, creating something that looked almost like a flight of low, shallow stairs. Over the treacherous blocks danced the winter she. Beautiful, didn't come close. It didn't start to come close. Men and women danced together, dressed in the regalia of the 1940s, stockings, knee-length skirts, dress uniforms of both the Army and the Navy that looked authentic to the month and year. The hairstyles and evidence corresponded as well, though the color didn't always match the setting. One she-girl I saw wore hers dyed sapphire blue, and other wore braids of silver and gold or of other colors. Here and there, light gleamed from metal or gems set into ears, brows, or lips, and the riot of subtle colors gathered around each and every dancer in its own distinct, fascinating nimbus, a corona of energy, of power manifesting itself as the she danced. Even without the whirling auras, the way they moved was something hypnotic in itself, and I had to force my eyes away from it after only a few seconds of lovely legs being displayed as a woman spun, body arched back underneath the strong man's hands, throats bared and breasts offered out, as hair caught the gleam of the colored lights and threw it back in waves of color.